I'm going to be turning to the book of Esther. Esther, you can turn to chapter 3. That's where we'll plan to begin. I want to join Kirk in welcoming you. Glad that you're here. We're going to go ahead and get into it. We're just going to cover the whole book of Esther tonight. So be ready to turn, and we'll be moving through and making some points quickly. But there is so much in this book and so many things about it that make it a fascinating book for me in studying it. Three things I'd point out at the beginning. One of the most powerful things is it's historically accurate. When you look at the way that the city of Shushan, it's also called Susa, is portrayed in this book, and the way that the Persian customs are, and you compare that to historians like Herodotus, they're spot on. Now, the Bible's representation of Persian culture and this place in this time, it is absolutely in agreement with history, which doesn't surprise us, but it may surprise a lot of people in the world. And it's just one of those things that we can look to and say, well, of course it's accurate. It was guided by the Holy Spirit. It's going to be spot on. Don't be surprised by those things. But it's wonderful to be able to look through and see that aspect of it. Another one of the peculiar things about the book of Esther, God's name is never written down in the book. It's never mentioned. God's name is absent from the pages of Esther, but he's not. He is all over it. He is all throughout the book of Esther. His providence flows from beginning to end of the book, and we'll get to see some more of that as we go through it. It's just a reminder, this book, that God rules in the kingdoms of men. He always has, he always will, and you get to see the pieces falling into place as we go through this book and see his hand in these things. And hopefully what that'll do is help us to realize God's always working for the good of his people. Even today, even if we're unable to see it, he is still working for the good of his people, and we need to trust and depend in that, and depend on that. One last thing. Those who honor God are not to be idle, even in the face of opposition. God's providence throughout this book is manifested in the actions of men and women. And though God doesn't take away free will, he expects his people to respect him and to do the things that he's given for them to do. And certainly, even in the face of opposition when trouble comes. So, sort of three things for us to kind of keep in the back of our minds as we go through this book. Another thing to remember, just to help us as we sort of try to plant ourselves in this time frame, around 480 BC, somewhere in there, the Persian Empire ruled the world. And they were incredible. Just massive and powerful kings, powerful conquest. And though some of the Jews returned to Jerusalem, many stayed. After the Babylonian captivity was over, they stayed in those lands which became Persian lands. So you've got Jews all over the Persian realm, the Persian Empire. So let's keep that in mind as we're looking at this as well. And this may be one of the biggest points, and I don't think I've ever thought about it before, in studying the book of Esther. Haman's threat to kill the Jews was meant to be total genocide. I think there have been times when I've read it that I was thinking, well, you know, the Jews in Shushan are in trouble. The Jews right around there in the region of Babylon, they're in trouble. No. Every Jew on the planet was in trouble. If Haman had his way, he would have erased every child of Abraham from the face of this earth. What would that have done to God's promise? That there would be a Savior that would come through Abraham's seed. Gone and done. If his plan had gone through, all of that would have been wiped out. And I say that to ask the question, do you think God's interested in what's going on in the book of Esther? Do you think he's interested in the welfare of his people and in this plan and in Esther and Mordecai and all of these things? We better believe it. This is a huge, huge deal that's covered in this book. And I don't know that it's really sunk in that heavily with me before. So let's begin. Chapter 3. Esther chapter 3. We'll start talking there in verse 1. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. He's a man who loved this kind of stuff. He loved the attention. He loved the authority. He loved the power. And he has been promoted by the king now to basically prime minister. And so as he's going through the town, everybody's bowing to him and everybody's honoring him. And Haman's eating that stuff up. except, verse 2, all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. The king's servant who were within the gate said to Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's command? And we're not given an answer there. We're not told why Mordecai refused to bow to this man. Obviously, the Jews bowed to God. Certainly they did that. But if you study some, they bowed to their kings. Nathan the prophet bowed to David. But there was something about Haman that Mordecai, he just could not do it. Maybe he saw it as idolatry, the way that it was done. Some have suggested that Haman may have been wearing an idol. And so to bow to him, Mordecai said, I can't do it. I don't know. Whatever the reason was, he was convicted. And he would not honor Haman the way he wanted to be. He didn't know it at first. But when it's told to Haman, he goes absolutely ballistic. Pick up in around verse 5. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. This is the whole Persian realm. This is everywhere. Everywhere in the known world, he wants to kill them all. Now, can you imagine that? Someone from a certain country insults me, and instead of just wanting to get vengeance on him, I'll kill everybody in Ireland. I mean, that's the attitude. I don't want to just harm him and get back at him. I want all of his people dead. That's the kind of man we're dealing with. And Haman, vindictive. That vengeance is just pouring through him. A lot of pride, obviously, that's going into this as well. Drop down to verse 8. So he goes to his king, Ahasuerus, and he tells him, these Jews are a problem, sir. You've got this race of people among your people who are just a bunch of troublemakers. They have their own law. They got a separate law from the Persian law. And then, verse 8, we'll just read through there. There are certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. And he goes on in verse 9, if it pleases you, let's write a decree and let's kill them all. And we may look at this and say, well, who would agree to that? That sounds crazy. The Persian kings at this time had a problem. The Greeks were starting to fight back, and it wasn't pretty, and they weren't happy about this kind of stuff. The last thing that Ahasuerus wants is an uprising in the midst of his nation, his empire. So when he hears there are a bunch of lawbreakers who abide by their own rules, what's he thinking? I mean, that's not good. We can't have that. Well, on top of this, Haman says, and I'll tell you what else I'll do. I'll give you 10,000 talents of silver into the king's treasury myself. So if you know, Ahasuerus is a calculating mind, and he says, yeah, maybe we need to get rid of him, but boy, that's going to cost a lot of money. And Haman says, I'll pay for all of it. And he says, okay, where do I need to sign? He signs the decree into, he stamps it with the seal, the king's ring, and it becomes law. And you remember the laws of the Medes and the Persians. What happens when they sign a decree into law? It's done. Can't change it. Can't wake up the next day and say, man, that was a terrible idea. We should erase that. No, it is set. It is carved in stone, as we would say. Haman mixes truth with lies to get to this point. The Jews did have their own law, but they weren't a bunch of lawbreakers of the Persians trying to stir up trouble. But Haman says what he needs to say. He sways Ahasuerus, and then it's signed into being this new law. Drop down to verse 13. Lots are cast, and the day is determined that it's going to be the 13th day of the 12th month. And on that day, let's pick up at verse 13, letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to plunder their possessions. And a copy of this is sent to all the provinces. Everyone under Persian rule now has this. This is a command from the throne that says on the 13th day of the 12th month, all the Jews are to be killed. Man, woman, and child, all of their stuff is to be plundered. What do you do? What can you do? This is sent from the king. Every Jew is to be exterminated. By all appearances, it seems like Haman's going to get his way. It seems like he's going to get exactly what he wants, and every Jew on the planet is going to be exterminated. But Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 11. "For I am with you, says the Lord," speaking to the Israelites, "to save you. Though I make a full end of all nations where I have scattered you, yet I will not make a complete end of you." He goes on to say, I may punish you. And he did. And he would. But I will not let you come to a complete end. He promised. God himself has promised the Jews, you won't be completely destroyed. So no, it's not going to work out for Haman. Because the Lord himself is involved in this. And he'll use men, he'll use women, but he's going to make sure that his people are protected. God rules in the kingdoms of men. Well, let's talk about Esther. Esther the queen is dearly beloved by King Ahasuerus, and she's a Jew, but this fact's not known. Her uncle Mordecai told her once she gets into that position, don't tell anybody that you're a Jew. Keep that secret, and she obeys him. She was always obedient to him. He's her adoptive father. He's taken care of her since she was a child. Mordecai hears the news. Go to chapter 4. Look at verse 1. He hears that this decree has been made, and when he learns what's happened, he tore his clothes, he put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city, and he cried with a loud and bitter cry. He's not being overly dramatic. He knows what this means. If this happens, that's it. He and all of his people are done. They are cut off from the history of the world. This is very serious. And he goes to the gate of the palace, and he's weeping and wailing out there. And somebody comes and tells Esther, and she says, here, take him some clothes. She doesn't even know what's going on yet. And they say, what is going on? What is all this about? He tells her, he sends a copy of the decree to her. And now she realizes just how serious this threat is to her and to her people. Look at verse 8. "Show it to Esther, the decree, explain it to her, that he might command her to go into the king and make supplication to him and plead before him for your people." Esther, you've got to go in and talk to the king about this. But what's the problem? King can't change it. It doesn't matter if you are the king. You can't change the law of the Medes and Persians once it's been written down, once it's been recorded. What are they going to do? What? Do we just wait? Do we just give up? If she goes in, what's she going to say to the king? He can't change it. And then you run into another problem. The more immediate problem is, I can't just go into the king, she says. Anybody who comes into his court without being summoned, he puts them to death. Unless he holds out that golden scepter, which excuses them and allows them, exempts them from that punishment, they're going to die on the spot. So she's like, well, I don't know what I'm going to say. What are we going to do about this? And if I go in, he hasn't called for me in 30 days. What if I've lost favor with him? What if he's in a foul mood? He could kill me on the spot and we're still without anything. You see some incredible faith by Mordecai here. Look at verse 13. I believe his response can be broken down into three parts. So let's read it. Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" So three parts to his response to his adoptive daughter. Number one, don't think you're going to be all right. When this goes down and all the Jews are killed, it's coming to you too, palace or no palace. You can't escape this. So there's one. Number two, you know what? Even if you don't do anything, the Lord's going to deliver his people. You and your family, your father's family will come to an end. But the Lord will deliver the Jews from another source. What an incredible statement of faith. Mordecai believes God is going to take care of us one way or another. I think it's you. But if it's not, he'll take care of us some way. Reminds me of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. If the Lord chooses to save us, he can. But even if he doesn't, we're not bowing down to your idols. The Lord is still the Lord. He's powerful. His way is right. And then his third point. Esther, this may be exactly why you're here. For such a time as this. This may be why you are in the position that you're in. God's hand moves in the affairs of men. He used the Persian ruler Cyrus before this. Mordecai realizes those things. Men like Haman and King Ahasuerus, he can use them too. You talk about Mordecai's faith, but look at Esther's. Look at verse 15. She was hesitant at first, but now look at her response. Reply to Mordecai, go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. What do? Mordecai, you tell every Jew you can find, start fasting. And I will tell my maidens the same thing. And for 3 days, day and night, we will fast. Now, what's interesting to me in this, in the Old Testament, whenever fasting happened, we see it's accompanied by prayer. So God is here. His name's not mentioned. It doesn't mention prayer, but it's there. I'm convinced that they're praying while they're fasting. Mark your places. We're not going to leave very much, but go to Ezra chapter 8. Verse 21, Ezra 8, verse 21. This is when Ezra's leading a group of people back into the land. With all the things they're taking with them, there's the threat of bandits and danger on the road and that sort of thing. Notice what he does. Ezra 8, verse 21, then I proclaimed a fast there at the river of Ahava, that we might humble ourselves before our God and seek from him the right way for us and our little ones and all our possessions. Verse 23, so we fasted and entreated our God for this, and he answered our prayer. Yeah, they fasted, but what else did they do? They prayed to him. Those two just went together. And I'm convinced that's what's going on with Esther and her maidens and all the other Jews in the land. They are praying and fasting before God, asking for his help in this. That's great faith and a brilliant idea. This is what needs to be done. And then I love the end. If I perish, I perish. Now, if it doesn't work out, then I'll die. I'll die doing the right thing. Acts chapter 7, Stephen. It's not going to end well. But what did he do anyway? He told the Jews what they needed to hear. He died doing the right thing. If we can believe history, what happened to Peter and Paul both? They died for their faith. They died doing the right thing. If I perish, I perish. I'm going to perish doing what is right in the Lord's sight. So turn to chapter 5. Esther, chapter 5. She goes before the king. I cannot imagine what she's feeling like. She puts on her royal robes. She goes down to the court. He hasn't sent for her in a month. She doesn't know if she's going to have favor in his sight. And then verse 2, let's pick up. So it was when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court that she found favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. And the king said to her, what do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you up to half the kingdom. So let's ask this. Did she find favor in his sight? Boy, did she. It's like his eyes light up when he looks over there and he sees her standing right there about to come into the court. Come here, come in. Here's the scepter. What is it you wish? I'll give you half the kingdom. Yeah, she's found some favor in his sight. But all she asked for at this time is a dinner date. The king and Haman are to come and dine with her. Well, he requests it, certainly. Look at verse 6. They go to the banquet of wine, and the king says to Esther, see, he's no fool. He knows that she didn't go to all this trouble just to have a date night with the king, with Haman there. What is your petition? It shall be granted to you. And again, he makes the point, up to half the kingdom, it shall be done. And she says, come back tomorrow, and I'll tell you what my request is. Well, he knows that there's something more, but he's okay with that. He's going to come back tomorrow. Look at verse 9. Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart. Stop there. Don't read anymore. Imagine for an arrogant man like Haman what just happened. He just had dinner with the king and queen of Persia. What is he thinking? I am the coolest person I've ever seen. I am fantastic. I just got to eat with the two greatest people in the world. And he is smiling and grinning, and he gets to the king's gate and he sees Mordecai, and Mordecai, when I honor him, and all that smile and all that joy just turns to ashes in his mouth, and he's sick. He's just furious. What a pathetic situation. What a miserable man. You got all of these blessings, and then one thing sets you off, and I don't care about any of that. I just can't stand that guy. Can't believe he's still alive. He goes home and he starts complaining about it. His wife and his friends are there. And his friends say, you know what you ought to do? You ought to build a gallows. It's 50 cubits high. That's 75 feet, if my math's right. And you ought to ask the king tomorrow if you can hang Mordecai on that thing. That'll make you feel better. And he says, well, that's a fantastic idea. So I assume, because it's ready the next day, I guess he gets his carpenters and they work all night building this gallows to hang Mordecai on. There's just one thing. You got to ask permission from the king first. So first thing in the morning, Haman is going to go to the king's court and ask if he can put him to death, Mordecai. Things are looking bad. This is the prime minister of Persia. You think the king's going to listen to his request? He's already granted his request to kill every Jew on the planet. Yeah, he'll probably let him hang one. This is terrifying. Look at chapter 6, verse 1. That night, the king could not sleep. I wonder what caused that. I wonder who caused that. He's restless, just can't get any peace, can't calm down. So he goes and apparently he wants a little light reading. Read me the Chronicles of my kingdom. So a scribe goes and gets the book of the Chronicles of the kingdom, and they're read before the king. And as the scribe is reading, they find this place, verse 2, where there was this conspiracy by two of the king's servants, two eunuchs. They wanted to kill King Ahasuerus, and somebody found out about it and warned the king. And guess who that somebody just happened to be? Mordecai the Jew. And so the king asks and says, because it's kind of a big deal saving the king's life. Well, what has been done to reward Mordecai for this? And apparently the clerk looks through and says, well, nothing. We haven't done anything for him. Who's out in the court? Who's out there? Well, my Lord Haman, he's out there. Send him in. To me, this is one of the funniest parts of this whole story. The strange thing about arrogance is, if you are extremely arrogant, you just always assume that people are talking about you. You just always, for good or ill, you just always assume that you're the center of everybody's attention. So when he comes before the king asks him this question. Let's go down to verse 6. Haman walks in. He's ready to ask, can I kill Mordecai? And the king says, I've got a question for you. What should be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman says, oh, he's being coy. He's talking about me. I'll tell you what you ought to do. You should take one of the robes that you've worn, one of the kingly robes, and you should place that on his shoulders. And then go get one of your horses that you've ridden with a big royal crest on its head, and you put him on that horse. And then you get one of your greatest princes to lead him around all over the city and proclaim his greatness before all the people. That's what the guy would really like for you to do for him. And the king says, that's a fantastic idea. Go get the robe. Here's the robe. Go get the horse. And then go take Mordecai the Jew and walk him all around the city proclaiming that the king has honored him before everybody. I would pay money to see the look on Haman's face when he told him that. He said, well, you talk about a bad day. It's going to get worse. But you walk in thinking you're going to get to kill your nemesis. And then the king says, hey, I want to honor this guy who's I'm just so happy with. Well, okay. And you give him this great idea, and now you are walking around leading your most hated enemy in a horse around the city, telling everybody how great he is, how much the king loves him. He's sick over this, angry. It's going to get worse, though, because he still has a date with the king and the queen that night. Chapter 7. The king and Haman dine with Queen Esther once again. And the king, of course, he knows that she wants something. Verse 2, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. What is your request up to half the kingdom? He's serious about this, by the way. He'll give her whatever she wants. She answered, verse 3, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given to me at my petition and my people at my request. Stop. You are the king and you are her husband. And she says, what I really want is for my life to be saved. Does she have your attention? What in the world is going on? You can imagine. Ahasuerus, not exactly the even-killed type. You know, it didn't take a whole lot to provoke him. His wife that he loves like crazy is threatened. Her people are threatened. Verse 4, for we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed and annihilated. If we had been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue. They're trying to wipe us out. He's furious. Look at verse 5. He answered and said to Queen Esther, who is he and where is he who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing? You just show me. Show me where he is. He's close. Verse 6, Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Well, I bet he was. He walked in and thought he was going to have another dinner date. And here he's just been accused of trying to assassinate the queen. He's terrified. The king gets up and walks out into the garden. He must be fuming, steam coming off. And so he just walks out there. You know he's shocked. You know he's mad. Apparently, in the meantime, Haman throws himself on the couch where Esther is. And he's begging and pleading, you know, for his life. Well, the king turns around and comes back in. And what does he see? Here's Haman all draped over his wife. And he asks the question, verse 8, will he also assault the queen while I am in the house? He's not even going to wait. He's trying to assault my queen right now. That's all his servants need to hear. They snatch up Haman. They cover his face, which was symbolic of this is the one who is about to bear the judgment of the king. And then a very helpful eunuch speaks up. Harbona, verse 9. Look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman. Just, hey, I know what we could do. Got some brand new gallows there. He wanted to kill the guy who, you know, saved your life. And King Ahasuerus says, hang him on it. So Haman dies on the very gallows he had built for Mordecai. Well, things are looking better for the Jews, but there's still a problem, isn't there? Haman's not the major problem anymore. The problem is that decree that's been signed. Dead Haman or not, the Jews are going to die in the 12th month on the 13th day. Something has to be done about that. Look at verse chapter 8. A couple of things. Mordecai is raised to the position of prime minister. He's raised to Haman's position. Queen Esther goes before him again and again says, "What? Something has to be done for my people." So she shows her courage yet again. The king gives Mordecai his signet ring and says, "All right, fix it. Do something to fix it. It's on you." Mordecai draws up a decree, seals it with the king's seal, and sends it with haste to every province. Chapter 8, look at verse 11. By these letters, the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children, women, and plunder their possessions. One day, guess what day it is? On that day, 12th month, 13th day, all the Jews can band together and they can rise up and they can slay any one of their enemies and the king won't say a thing about it. Now they can fight back. Well, something else happens, chapter 9, verse 3. When this decree goes out, all the people, especially the other officials, they become afraid of Mordecai and the Jews. And so they start befriending them, and they're actually going to help them when this day comes. Verse 3, all the officials of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, all those doing the king's work, helped the Jews because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. Verse 5, when that day came, the Jews defeated all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and destruction, and did what they pleased with those who hated them. Now, all of that to ask this question. Can you see the providence of God in this book? I mean, just kind of go back and trace some of this. Mordecai's decree allowed the Jews to avert disaster, but how did he even get to the point where he could write a decree? Well, you go back because the king had extended that scepter to Esther a second time when she went to him again. Without that, the king, he would never have ordered a second decree to be written. Well, how did Mordecai happen to be the guy who was chosen to do that? Because he had been raised to Haman's position in Haman's place. Because he had saved the king's life on that day earlier, and nothing had been done about it to reward him then. And because he was the queen's close kinsman, all this stuff is just accident, right? Well, how was Mordecai even alive at this point to be made Haman's successor? Do you realize how much hinges on the fact that Haman got to court early that morning, but not early enough? He comes in expecting to get there. He wants his business to be first. But the king couldn't sleep the night before. So he's been having the Chronicles read to him. And before he realizes Haman is out there, the clerk reads about Mordecai saving his life. If he had got in to the king before the clerk read that, Mordecai would have died. But it just so happened, the clerk reads that. Then the king realizes Haman is in. Then he calls him in and asks about what should be done. Why were the Chronicles being read to him to begin with? Because he couldn't sleep that night. Just an accident. How was it that the king had forgotten to honor Mordecai at the time he saved his life, but was reminded of the good deed at exactly the moment that was needed to save Mordecai's life and to save all the Jews? Go back farther. How was it that this young Jewish woman was queen of Persia anyway? That doesn't seem that likely. How did that happen? Because the king's first queen, Vashti, had refused to meet his drunken demands to show herself off to his lords. This woman would not sacrifice her modesty and her sense of decency even before the king himself. And because of that, she had to know she was going to pay for it. He's drunk on top of everything else. She loses her position, which opens the door for this young Jewish woman who's been blessed with beauty of face and body, and most importantly, character, to come in, take that position, and be the queen that has favor in the sight of the king. Just a bunch of accidents, huh? No way. God's providence is all over the book of Esther. It's incredible. Over the course of years, through thousands of actions to protect his people, to preserve the lineage of the Christ. Go back to Esther 4. We're going to read this one last time, verse 13. This is the answer that Mordecai sends back to Esther. Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. This last part's what I want us to see. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Here's the whole point of this lesson. Could you be the very person for this moment? And I'm especially thinking of our young people who are going back, our young adults who are going back to college. Could you be the very person that could teach somebody else or influence somebody else to obey the gospel or to start being interested in God and wanting to learn about His ways? Could you be the one because you're friends with them? Because they respect you. They've seen your character. It's consistent. And they like you. They're willing to listen. You may be the very person. I may never meet them. I may never get to see them. The elders may never see them. Bill may never see them. But you see them every single day. How do you not know that you may not be there for such a time as this? Take advantage of that opportunity to be the light that we ought to be. We don't know who we might be able to influence. As Christians, we ought to be anti-chameleons. Everybody just wants to fit in and be just like the rest of the world. That's not who we are. We're to be the Lord's people. We should stand out, not because we're freaks, but because we love the Lord. And we're willing to follow Him regardless of what the rest of the world's doing. One last verse. Two more verses. Turn to 1 Corinthians 16. Look at verse 13. Not a long verse, but a powerful one. 1 Corinthians 16, verse 13. Watch, stand fast in the faith, be brave, be strong. And the next verse, of course, let everything you do be done with love as well. Stand fast, stand by faith. Be immovable in your faith. Be strong in it. And when those difficult times come, remember Esther. Remember this book. And when we ask, Lord, why is this happening to me right now? The answer might be because you're the very one who can do something about it. That's why. Do we ever consider it like that? One more verse, Ezekiel 22. Ezekiel 22, we'll look at verse 30. Our world is a mess, morally and spiritually. But even in times such as this, the Lord has always looked for somebody who would stand up and do His will. Can He depend on us to do that? Verse 30 of Ezekiel 22. So I sought for a man among them who would make a wall, stand in the gap before me on behalf of the land that I should not destroy it. But I found no one. When the Lord looked out across Judah, the people just didn't care. That's why they went into captivity. He couldn't find those who were willing to stand up for His cause. And so they paid for it. Well, will He find us when He looks? God providentially cares for His people. But will you and I do the part that He's given to us? Go ahead and get your song books out. He will certainly take care of His part. No question about that. But He has given all of us a part we can do as well. There are things we can do. There are people we can influence. Are we the light that we should be? Let's consider those things. We might need to repent if we're not. We might just need to work harder. We might need to become a child of His. If any of those things apply to us, let's do that now as we stand and sing.